You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren.
To the rich man's bright lodges I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
When I arrived at the house at 3240 17th Avenue South in Minneapolis, the police and city inspectors were boarding up the house. The city said they had to board up the house because the owner wasn't available, but the owner was in jail. Bruce Nestor of the National Lawyers Guild was on hand to explain what happened.
I got a phone call from our legal hotline that a raid was happening. The occupants called the hotline. I live about four blocks away, and I was at my office, which is actually three blocks away. I said I would come over. So I got here about 8:15, and there were 20 to 25 officers present. One of the first things I saw, there was an officer with a kind of an army helmet and an automatic weapon, automatic rifle over his and flak jacket coming out. A number of other officers in bulletproof vests, armed, and then a number of undercover officers.
Do you think the raid took place right around 8-ish?
I understand it happened right around 8. The warrant did not authorize a nighttime execution.
You included?
And then kind of, I think off the top of my head, I think that means they got to wait until 8 a.m. to do it.
Have you seen the warrant?
I have.
And what did it say?
The warrant, it wasn't the application for the warrant to establish probable cause. It just describes what can be searched for. It was very broad. I'd say one category of stuff was political literature, computers, notebooks, that type of information. The second category kind of would be common household items, paint, spray paint, twine, cardboard. And then it ran all the way up to Molotov cocktails or preparations for Molotov cocktails. So it was a very broad warrant, basically authorizing the seizure of all computers, MP3 players, any electronic device, any political literature, many common household items.
So they did take some things and left with items out of this home?
They did. They seized cash from the home. They seized, I just had a brief chance to view the inventory before we sent it off to be copied. They took foam mattresses. They took old tires. They took cans of paint thinner. I saw the truck. It was loaded with stuff that's in my garage right now.
Hmm. Are you representing?
I represent the homeowner, Monica Bicking. B-I-C-K-I-N-G.
B-I-C-K-I-N-G.
I was present. So there were 13 people in the home. 10 were released within about an hour. They were all forced to lie face down. They were all handcuffed. They were handcuffed throughout the duration of the search. And then 10 of them were released one by one. Three people out of this home were arrested, and I was told by Sergeant Jay Maher, M-A-H-E-R, of Ramsey County Special Investigations Intelligence Unit, that those individuals were being charged with conspiracy to commit riot.
So 13 in the home. 13 yep. were placed under some sort of supervision.
13 were detained. 3 were arrested.
3 were arrested.
And according to the Hennepin County jail records, they're being held on probable cause, which means they were not, no formal charge has been issued. No complaint has been reviewed or signed by a prosecutor or a judge, but the police have just detained these people. They can be held on probable cause until Wednesday at 12 noon. In my view, this is a preventive detention action by the Ramsey County Sheriff's Department. It's designed to keep people off the streets. It's designed to scare people from participating in protest activity. The single best thing that other citizens can do is to speak out against these violations of people's rights and to come out in the streets and join people in a democratic exercise over the next week.
This raid warranted or unwarranted, then, in your opinion?
Look, if this raid was warranted, people would be arrested on criminal complaints. You know, they executed a warrant last night at the Convergence Center, and I'll guarantee you, I may be wrong, but I'll guarantee you, they did not seize any illegal evidence of illegal activity out of that Convergence Center. This is a politically motivated raid. The charge used here was used to prosecute the Chicago 8 in 1968. That charge, widely seen in legal circles, as a politically motivated charge. Conspiracy allows you to drag in evidence of political advocacy. Really, what this is about is criminalizing free speech activity and doing it without specific evidence of a crime. It's claiming that they, you know, the idea of a conspiracy to commit a riot is simply a dragnet charge designed to hold people when you lack evidence that they have really done anything illegal.
How many raids do you know of so far?
Three so far in South Minneapolis today, and then the other at the Convergence Center last night.
Okay, so that's four then.
That's right.
Okay. And the Convergence Center, has that been bolted shut?
Boarded shut without authority, as I understand, but not on first-hand knowledge. Dave Thune, a St. Paul City Council person, has worked with city regulatory staff so that will be reopened by this afternoon. But again, I just heard that. I don't know that firsthand. Okay. I've got to go and speak to this guy right here.
What other groups do you represent then?
I'm a president of the Minnesota chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. Most of my public comments are in that capacity, but my representation to this house is with the owner of the house.
How upset are you?
You know, I mean, this police do this all the time.
I just need a contact from my guy.
Okay.
Okay? Okay. Just call me.
I mean, I'm upset because I pay taxes here. I want people to have a police force that protects them, that doesn't suppress their rights. I believe that, you know, we have a tremendous amount of idealism and hope coming to our streets in the next few days to speak out for change, and not just, you know, the Democratic Party type of change, but change that this country really needs. And it's horrible that our police force and our tax dollars are going to suppress that idealism and that energy rather than to celebrate it. We know the convention's a pre-scripted operation. What's happening in the streets is really a democratic exercise. We should be embracing that. As an attorney, a member of the legal profession, I embrace it. I embrace people exercising their rights. I wish that's what the entire city was doing.
Okay, well, thank you so much. Were the people in here, you think they were planning to peacefully protest in your opinion?
Yep. You know, and look, even though everyone's getting outraged about the anarchists, okay? The worst thing that's being said that people are trying to do is blockade streets. No one is talking about hurting people. You know, the police in Denver say, oh, we arrested people because missiles were thrown at us, rocks were thrown at us. There's hundreds of cameras, hundreds of video cameras in Denver. Not a single picture. These are made-up threats by the police. We are not threatened. Our public security is not threatened by a blockaded street. Our society can survive if the Republican National Convention runs an hour or two behind schedule because a delegate bus is delayed. We can deal with this without violating people's rights and with recognizing that the right to protest doesn't just mean sending emails. It means getting out in the streets, speaking loud, and maybe doing things that not everybody approves of, but aren't violent and don't threaten our society.
A report filed August 30 by Ken Avador from Minneapolis on the eve of the Republican convention. This show is being produced on August 31st, and I know this report will be old news for most listeners by the time you hear it. Thus, I offer it not as breaking news, but as exhibit number one to support the analysis made by Susan Rosenthal in her book, Power and Powerlessness, our ongoing reading. I'm Lynn Gary, and you're listening to Unwelcome Guests. The report concluded with a statement from the National Lawyers Guild attorney that the actions of the protesters pose no threat, but that depends on where you stand. He noted that the protesters who had been preventatively arrested were advocating for change and not the Democratic Party kind, which is precisely why they were the targets of state repression. They are people with a dangerous idea, the return of human society to its ancient rules of reciprocity and equality, described in our reading last week. Ideas that challenge the legitimacy of a state based on the rules of capitalism. seize the surplus, and compete or die. As Susan Rosenthal pointed out in last week's reading, these are rules put in place by humans, which we can, and actually must, I believe, change. The deadly nature of capitalist rule number 2, compete or die, will be the focus of our reading this week. We'll set the stage with a discussion of what economic historian Webster Tarpley calls the worst financial crisis of human history. He was interviewed by Bonnie Faulkner of KPFA's Guns and Butter program 1 month ago. Here's Bonnie Faulkner.
Webster Tarpley is an economic historian, author, and lecturer. He is author of 9/11 Synthetic Terror, Made in the USA, Against Oligarchy, a collection of essays and speeches from the years 1970 to 1996, and co-author of George Bush, The Unauthorized Biography. He is also author of Surviving the Cataclysm, A Study of the World Financial Crisis, Your Guide to the Greatest Financial Crisis in Human History. Webster Tarpley's latest book is Obama, The Postmodern Coup, The Making of a Manchurian Candidate. Soon to be published is Obama, The Unauthorized Biography. Webster Tarpley, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Almost 1 year ago today, we produced a series of economic shows, The U.S. Banking System, Too Big to Bail Out, and From Collapse to Disintegration, How to Stop the Depression. At that time, 1 year ago, you spoke in great detail about many aspects of economic disintegration, and at one point said, the price of a barrel of oil has averaged over the last year at $70 a barrel. You attributed 25% of this price to speculation. Well, today $70 a barrel sounds pretty cheap. So how would you characterize the last year in economic terms?
Well, it has been a year of ongoing economic breakdown crisis, ongoing dollar agony, banking panic, and hyperinflation, which is what's going on in oil, food, and so many other areas. So that is indeed dollar hyperinflation, the things that we talked about. It was about a year ago, yesterday, that Jim Cramer of CNBC Business News gave his famous ranting speech that you may remember, where he demanded that Bernanke and the Federal Reserve do something to bail out Cramer's friends at Goldman Sachs, Bear Stearns, and the various trading desks of the Wall Street investment houses, the so-called investment banks. This was a huge event. It was something that 2 or 3 million people have viewed on YouTube, in addition to the normal listeners. And it was a demand that Bernanke realized that all considerations of inflation had to go out the window, and that what had to happen was emergency action to bail out these banks that he represents, Cramer does, and to try to prevent what they call systemic crisis. Now, a systemic crisis would be the moment where the interbank payment system among the principal money center banks, it's called in the United States CHIPS, Clearinghouse Interbank Payment System. There's a process at the end of every trading day that they call settlement, where they tote up and they make aggregates of everything that every bank owes to every other bank. And at the end, they add those up, and the pluses or minuses then get paid. If I owe your bank more than your bank owes me, then I've got to pay you the difference and so forth. But if one or more of the major players has gone bankrupt during the day, that system goes into crisis. It goes into tilt. And we've been at that point several times over the last 30, 40 years. But he was talking about something like that happening in the short run. Now, in the meantime, we have had a process by which the Federal Reserve, responding, I guess, to this crisis that Cramer is talking about, has entered into the business of shoring up first the banks in terms of providing lending at the discount window and so forth. They have vastly increased the degree to which they are lending money not only to banks but then to investment banks and now also to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So we now have a very interesting situation. If you wanted to go out and start a steel mill or something obviously productive, you would have to pay a relatively high interest rate. But if you were a bankrupt financial institution seeking financing, you would get preferential low credit rates. Now, my idea of economics would be to do the opposite. If you want to do something productive, you should get the low government-subsidized credit rate, interest rate. And if you want to do something speculative, you should take your chances in the market. So we now have a completely dysfunctional system. And this came in a series of steps from last August until now. The Fed has gone deeper and deeper into this, responding to the crisis. The most recent event of this was the decision to bail out Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, these two giant mortgage lenders and mortgage guarantors that go back to the New Deal. Fannie Mae in particular does, founded in 1938. They hold between $5 and $6 trillion of mortgages or guarantee them.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, with regard to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, these are corporate entities, aren't they? They're not government institutions.
They are what is called the hillbilly cousins of the U.S. Treasury. Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, Ginnie Mae, which is in somewhat better condition, that's government national mortgage, and then Sallie Mae, the student loan association. Fannie Mae was a government agency, which was then privatized in 1968. This is one of the features of today's crisis. These things should never have been privatized. Privatization is insane in most cases. Privatization is a bonanza and a windfall for rich, parasitical oligarchs, but it leaves a situation like this where they then run wild, and this is a bipartisan running wild. A lot of the people who did this are opportunists left over from the Clinton administration who created the situation we now have. This never should have been done. But there is what is called a residual guarantee. In other words, if I buy something that says U.S. Treasury bond, it says full faith and credit of the United States stands behind this. But if I buy a Fannie Mae stock or something like this, a bond in particular, not a stock, it seems to imply that they call it an implied guarantee or a semi-guarantee by the Treasury. So there was that aspect to it. You're sort of in a gray area. My recommendation for all of these entities is they should be seized and run as government agencies. If necessary, they can be put through Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Fannie and Freddie really ought to be. And that would be the way to get out of it. Now, let's just maybe we go back and try to chart the course of the crisis. Last August, at about the time we were talking, we had the first wave of banking panic, which was Countrywide Bank of California. It's a bank that was part of this countrywide mortgage lending entity, which has since been absorbed by Bank of America. And the head of that, Angelo Mozzillo, turns out to be a guy who's giving sweetheart mortgages to all kinds of people, including in the Obama campaign, but also to Republicans. Anyway, that was the first wave of banking panic. The banking panic then went over to the British Isles in October and November, and it's actually kept going. And this is Northern Rock, the fifth largest bank in Great Britain. They also had branches in Ireland. So this is an international banking panic. That crisis alone has already cost the British taxpayers easily 100 billion pounds, say 200 billion U.S. dollars has gone down that particular rat hole because they've tried to bail these entities out. Then around the middle of March, we had the panic run on Goldman, Bear Stearns. Now, with the Bear Stearns case, it's not a commercial bank, but it's an investment bank, meaning just accounting house, right, an investment house. But still, that was a panic run on them. And then we now have the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac crisis. So we're having these waves of banking panic every 2 to 3 months. Now, this is exactly what you had in the winter of 1932 to 1933, when, remember, in the course of 1932 and into 1933, every commercial bank and savings bank in the United States closed its doors. And by the time Franklin D. Roosevelt was inaugurated president, in those days it was done in March rather than in January, by that noon, every form of economic activity had been shut down. They had all stopped. So we're in a comparable kind of situation. In other words, this is a world economic depression. Let's call it the Bush economic depression, because I guess he's going to get credit for it. Now, fundamentally, what is happening? They say that it's a crisis of subprime mortgages. But as these characters on TV will also tell you, oh, but wait, mortgages that are in delinquency are only 1, 2, 3% of the whole mortgage market, and that in turn is only a small part of the bigger market. So what is it? The mortgage crisis, subprime mortgage crisis, and credit crisis that we see, and banking crisis, these are features of the crisis of what I would call the $1 quadrillion-plus derivatives bubble. We've had a worldwide asset bubble going for many, many years. It has ups and downs, right? We've had the dot-com bubble. We've had the Latin American loan bubble before that. But fundamentally, we've got these derivatives. I estimate them at $1 quadrillion plus now. The $1 quadrillion is already an old estimate. It's almost a year old. So maybe we're up to 1.2, 1.5 quadrillion. This means a quadrillion, of course, 1,000 trillion U.S. dollars. And actually, with the fall of the dollar, we may be pushing 2 quadrillion in terms of this bubble. It's very, very difficult to estimate because nobody wants to tell you about these things. Anyway, that's what's in crisis. Now, derivatives, many people don't even know what they are. When this stuff is discussed on television, they talk about these instruments or these securities or the need to unwind the book at Bear Stearns. What are they talking about? Derivatives by now are unmentionable. They were already unmentionable. They were a four-letter word already in the 1990s. There were some mutual funds who would try to tell you that they had no derivatives. Derivatives mean paper based on paper. A common stock is supposed to be a piece of a company. A bond of that company gives you a claim on them if they go bankrupt. But what about paper that's not based on any economic activity in the real world, but based on another piece of paper? A future, an option, or an index fulfills that. So everything that says future, option, index, and now we've got all the combinations and permutations of those. We've got, you know, stock, futures, options, indices, you know, pyramided. So that's one aspect of it. The other thing is the so-called structured note. In other words, when J.P. Morgan Chase and Citibank sit down, they write each other derivatives contracts that are called structured notes that build in various dimensions of risk, they claim, but really represent bets about which way something is going. So one bank is speculating one way and the other bank is speculating the other way. So we've got over-the-counter derivatives, and we've got exchange-traded derivatives, and then we have what I call designer derivatives. Those would be the structured notes. All of this has reached this unbelievable level, or somewhere way over $1 quadrillion. J.P. Morgan Chase, in particular, is the epicenter of this. They are easily in the 300 trillion to 400 trillion of derivatives. Now, let's talk about trillions. What's the value of the planet Earth and everything in it? Right? Add it all up. Right? How much is the world worth? Maybe 100 trillion? 150 trillion? I don't know, but it's something like that. It's sure not one quadrillion. So what they've done is created a mass of fictitious capital that doesn't have any correlative in the real world. It's a pyramid of paper promises to pay and fictitious capital and value that has no value, which has now gone into not even the ionosphere. It's gone into interplanetary, interstellar space. Or you could think about it as a black hole. That's the way I would describe most Wall Street investment houses today. You know the idea of the black hole, right? The gravity collapse and anything that gets near it gets sucked in, and there's nothing that can be done once you've got a black hole, right? Anything that gets sucked in just makes the black hole stronger. If you look at these things like Bear Stearns was obviously a black hole already a year ago, and they kept it going, and they kept it funded by the Federal Reserve openly, under the table, through the back door, every which way. But by the 15th of March of this year, Bear Stearns blew. It was insolvent, and their stock went from 70 to 2 over the weekend of the Ides of March, and the stockholders were hysterical. Now, think about what it means. The market, in quotes, there is no market, of course. It's a fiction. It's cartels, monopolies, and manipulation, and stock jobbers, and God knows what. But the market on Friday said it was worth, or one day a previous week, said 70, and then it went to 2. So what does that mean about the market? Obviously, the market doesn't work. There's a very serious epistemological problem here. As human beings, we've got to know what things are worth. In other words, you've got to know what's valuable, so we pursue what's valuable and avoid things that are deleterious and bad and toxic. Well, when it comes to toxic, all of these investment banks and banks represent a degree of toxicity which is absolutely beyond belief. They are black holes. Now, what happened on the weekend of March 15th was that a bigger black hole called J.P. Morgan Chase came along and ingested the smaller black hole, Bear Stearns. But that just made the black hole problem over at J.P. Morgan Chase even worse. And indeed, that's what I think most of these Wall Street commentators will tell you, that absorption has not gone well for Jamie Dimon and his merry men over at J.P. Morgan Chase, because you look at their stock price, that was in the doldrums. Now, we're therefore in the presence of this crisis. The problem with the quadrillion plus of derivatives was, as long as there was positive cash flow or positive leverage, the leverage, and what I mean by leverage is when you mobilize, say you need $100 to buy something, if you can put up $10 of your own and buy it by taking out a loan of $90, then you've got 10 to 1 leverage. In other words, you put in 10 and you've ended up with 100, so you've got 10 to 1 leverage. So you can mobilize more money by putting up some of your own and then borrowing more. When you get into the derivatives world, the leverages go up to 500, 1,000, and way beyond that. As long as there was a positive cash flow in this leveraged world of derivatives, the profits that came out at the top of that pyramid were huge. They were astronomical. But now, what is called the mortgage crisis, or the subprime mortgage crisis, the credit crunch, in other words, everything that has happened between July, August of 2007 and now, means that this entire derivatives Tower of Babel, has gone into negative leverage. So now, instead of pyramiding the profits at the top, the super profits and hyper profits, you've now got the losses being exponentially multiplied at the top. And that's essentially what's going on in the world economy. The $1 quadrillion plus of derivatives has gone into negative leverage, and they all run around screaming about this or that aspect of it, and the crisis unfolds. It goes from one bank to another, one sector to another, one country to another, even.
You mentioned the credit crunch, and you're talking about these multiple trillions in the credit crunch that's pyramiding downward, okay? But what about the credit crunch with regard to regular businesses? I mean, everybody's affected by this, right?
Yes, of course. What we're getting, you can see this in the latest, the Detroit sales statistics, or, you can take any industry you want. In the case of the United States, everybody knows that the backbone of the U.S. economy in terms of production is auto. And auto couldn't be worse. So we've just had these absolutely devastating collapse of the sales of Ford, GM, Chrysler. Chrysler has already been taken over by a hedge fund and is being destroyed. Ford and GM are hanging on, but it's thought that they'll go bankrupt soon. I suppose for the average American, if General Motors goes bankrupt, then you'll know that you're in a world economic depression. And maybe that will be a moment when people will understand something.
Well, now
it's
also
a contraction, though. Let me distinguish. I've been talking so far almost exclusively in the world of this financial paper. However, there's also the world of plant, equipment, jobs, wages, employment, supermarket purchases, gasoline pumps, and everything else. Now, what's the consequence for this quadrillion of derivatives? In other words, the crisis of the derivatives then obviously kicks over and has a tremendous impact on the world of real economics, and it's just devastating. One thing is these chain reaction bankruptcies. I mean, you turn on the TV, listen to the economics channels, and the only thing they're talking about is layoffs, plant closings, firings. In other words, we've had 7 or 8 months of shrinking employment, even in this crazy service-oriented post-industrial rubble economy that we've got, even that is now collapsing. And the few industrial jobs that are left are being decimated. That would be mainly Detroit, in other words, the big three automakers, if we can still call them that, and the subcontractors of those, these things like Delco, right, the people who make the parts for the automobile companies. All of that is collapsing. So there's a contraction of the real economy that I wrote about in that paper, Helicopter Ben Unleashes Dollar Hyperinflation. I went and looked at freight car loadings on the railroads, the ton miles of the trucking industry. That's where you can see a real economic downturn. I ought to go back and look at that as soon as possible, because I'm sure that's in decline. You've had 7 or 8 months of declining jobs, and then you've got this question of hyperinflation. What you see in the oil price is, in a context at least, of general hyperinflation. You got hyperinflation of food prices, hyperinflation of fuel, energy, and raw materials. Now, you always have violent corrections within that. In other words, we had the oil price got up almost to 150, and now it's back down to 125. That's normal. In other words, when you have a huge speculative hysteria, it goes through these moments of panic and correction. That's sort of what we've just had. But the march of hyperinflation, as far as I can see, continues. I'd like to talk specifically about the role of inflation in the oil and gasoline prices, though, because I think that's significant. But let me just get back to the derivatives, because this is where the problem is coming from. That is what is strangling the real economy in terms of energy, employment, wages, productive investment in the United States. There is none, and there hasn't been any in terms of plants and equipment for many a moon. What do you do about the derivatives? The approach that they've taken is, when they saw that Bear Stearns was about to blow up, they tried to lend them money. They set up a special lending facility for Bear Stearns. Didn't help. You couldn't lend them enough. They were going to be insolvent. Because, again, black holes can't be treated in that way. You've got to have some, super-duper ray that's going to deal with a black hole. But you can't deal with Bear Stearns by giving them more money. They just get more bankrupt. You cannot have them, one bank buying up another, because that it just takes the derivatives to someplace else, and then eventually there'll be a day of reckoning for J.P. Morgan Chase. The only way to deal with derivatives is to wipe them out. In other words, if Bear Stearns is in crisis, it should be seized. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the controller of the currency, the Commodity Futures Trading Corporation, the Securities and Exchange Commission should get together and say, okay, Bear Stearns, we are seizing you. And then what do you do? If they're bankrupt, probably, you can find that out in 5 minutes. They are. You put them through Chapter 11. Now, in the course of Chapter 11 bankruptcy, you distinguish among their asset classes. You can say, boys, you've got a prime brokerage that could work. You've got, some mortgage stuff over here that's sort of half and half. But you've got this derivatives book. You at Bear Stearns, you've probably got 100 trillion or 150 trillion of derivatives. You know what we're going to do with that book? We're going to shred it. We're going to delete it. We're going to wipe it out. We're going to say, this is of no value. It's gone. Yeah, but what about the counterparties of that? Well, the people who are on the other end of those deals, they'll just have to take cold turkey. Most of these derivatives were illegal in the United States until the early to mid-1990s. It was Greenspan, in his infinite wisdom, who essentially allowed these things. He reassured everybody that they would be legal, that they would stand up in court. But, of course, Greenspan is not the Supreme Court. Above all, an activist president, Franklin D. Roosevelt at this point, would simply say, I'm directing these federal regulatory agencies to go and seize Bear Stearns. A case we've just had is Lehman Brothers. Lehman Brothers was on the death watch. It was in the death spiral. As soon as Bear Stearns blew, everybody knew that Lehman Brothers was next, and they've been skirting the edge of the abyss now for many weeks. About 2 or 3 weeks ago, Lehman was about to go, and at that point there was a big operation done by the Federal Reserve and this thing called the Plunge Protection Team, the President's Working Group on Financial Markets, to try to get the price of oil down. They obviously did some selling operations into that, and to get some stocks up, but above all to get the money center banks up. Citibank was in the middle to low teens. J.P. Morgan Chase was going down. Goldman was not far behind. Lehman Brothers was in bad shape. Merrill Lynch was in bad shape. Union Bank of Switzerland in very bad shape. So they were able to turn that around by this trick that they pulled. They buy their futures of those stocks in Chicago, and if the Chicago futures go up, then the shares in New York follow through a kind of a mechanism that they've set up. They shouldn't do that. Lehman Brothers right now is obviously bankrupt. It should be seized. You shouldn't wait around. You shouldn't try to bail it out. You shouldn't, you know, send good money after the bad down this kind of a rat hole. Seize it, put it through Chapter 11 bankruptcy, and above all, wipe out that derivatives book.
Now, what you just described of the plunge protection team, that's how they manipulate the price?
So this was instituted. I think I'm the person who wrote about this before anybody in the world. It's in my Bush biography, which you can see online, the unauthorized biography of George H.W. Bush. I read about something called the Brady system of drugged markets. Now, Brady was on his way to be the Secretary of the Treasury for Bush the Elder. Right after the crash of 87, 20 years ago, more, Brady did a study group, or he was the figurehead of a study group from Goldman Sachs and these other places, that studied what had happened between the New York stock market and these new, at that time, new futures markets in Chicago, right, at the Chicago Board's Option Exchange, Chicago Board of Trade, and Chicago Merck. They had instituted this futures trading, which at that time was something new. It had started about 1981, 1982. So there was a relation between these two. The finding, and I saw this on television at the time, in a cold day with snow on the ground in January of 1988, Brady came out and said, okay, we've got this study. It's a big blue book. I've still got it up here in my room. It's a study of what happened in 1987. The thing that they concluded from this was the following, that if you can keep the price of the Chicago future above the price of the New York stock, the program trader will sell the future, why pay more, and buy the stock, meaning that with $10 million in Chicago, you can updraft the New York market to the tune of several hundred million, and in Chicago, you're operating under an even laxer regime in terms of margin and other stuff, because there it's the Commodity Futures Trading Corporation, which is practically non-existent, and in New York, it's the Securities and Exchange Commission, which is only pathetically weak. So it's even easier to do hanky-panky in the Chicago side, because the SEC isn't there. It's the CFTC. That's this guy Cox, if you've seen him in his pathetic antics. So that's how they do it, and that's called the plunge protection team. And they've done, you know, different ways of doing that, and they've refined that, I'm sure.
But when you say that these hedge funds, derivatives, some of these investment banking firms should be allowed to go bankrupt.
Not allowed. They should be seized.
Well,
they are bankrupt. See, this is the problem. They're bankrupt and they're pretending not to be. It used to be, I'll tell you an example. In the early 1990s, Citibank was seized. It was seized Thanksgiving 1991, I believe it is. I could check the date. Citibank was, in effect, insolvent. John Dingell, congressman of Michigan, still around, said Citibank is technically insolvent. When he said that, there was a panic run on the Citibank branches in Hong Kong, where people were more attuned to this kind of stuff.
Well, what does it mean to say that a bank is seized? What do they do if they...
The regulators come in and they say, guess what, executives? We're running the show, and you're going to do what we want. And if you don't, we have the federal marshals here to take you away.
Well, if they're bankrupt, what do you do with them?
Yeah, what if they're bankrupt? What if they're really bankrupt and they're pretending not to be because they're getting money from Helicopter Ben at the Federal Reserve to mask the fact that they're bankrupt? See, at a certain point, a regulatory regime, this is the difference between a real presidency and a real government, a Franklin D. Roosevelt, New Deal, activist, interventionist, potent kind of thing, and this monstrosity that we have today. Bush is not going to do that. Who's going to do that? You think Bush's SEC chairman is going to seize, or FDIC is going to start seizing banks? They won't do it.
Well, that's just what I was going to say. I mean, you can talk about what they should do, but that is not what they're doing.
No, of course not. They're doing the opposite. That's what I'm saying. I want to contrast, though, the option of their doing what they don't do, because this is what people forget, is that most of these, practically all of the so-called investment banks, it means Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers, Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley, they should be seized at this point because they are insolvent by any measure. Instead, what we've had is helicopter Ben Bernanke and the Federal Reserve coming forward and saying, we have special discount windows for you. We have special lending facilities. What they've done is come in and use the credit generating capabilities of the Federal Reserve to deal with the derivatives crisis, which is simply out of control. It cannot be treated in this way. In other words, everything they're doing will not work, and everything they're doing stokes hyperinflation because they have now injected how many trillions of dollars since last August? I've lost count, but we're in the many, many, many trillions of dollars. Price of gasoline. Let's just talk about that for a second, because this is the place now where the average American has realized that there is such a thing as speculation. We had Congressman Bart Stupak of Michigan held some very useful hearings. And actually, you can find out about these, of all places, at Nancy Pelosi's website, the speaker.gov, I think it's called. She's got a blog on there. And if you go back some weeks, I guess about a month now, Stupak had a bunch of actual experts in the oil market come in and talk about speculation. Now, this is a case study of how derivatives are used to rob the average person. You got to understand, when you go to the pump and you pay that $4, $4.50, $5 for a gallon of gas, you are subsidizing the derivatives bubble. You're paying into one quadrillion plus of derivatives. Yes, it's true the oil cartel does rob as much as they can, but that's nothing compared to what Goldman Sachs does and these Wall Street characters. They had a guy on there called Geith, his name was, from Oppenheimer. He's the oil expert from Oppenheimer. And Geith got on there and said, look, everything over $70 to $80 a barrel is pure speculation. So when he made those remarks, it meant that the other 70 or so above that was pure speculation. In other words, a parity price for oil. In other words, a price that reflects the actual cost of production, transportation, refinement, and everything else, plus a reasonable profit margin of, 5, 6, 7, 8%, would get you up to $70 or $80 a barrel for oil. The rest of it is pure speculation. Now, how did they do this? Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley decided that the conditions on the New York Mercantile Exchange and the New York Commodity Exchange, the New York COMEX in particular, were too regulated. They didn't like that. So they decided to create an offshore oil market, which is called ICE, the Intercontinental Exchange in London. But in London, it's actually, what can we call it, negative regulation. I guess the regulators are the accomplices of the criminal speculators and gougers. This now handles about half of the oil futures contracts and the oil futures indices in the world. And again, it's a creation of Goldman Sachs and of Morgan Stanley. And this is where you have this process of relentlessly bidding up the price. They used to have paper barrels of oil. The paper barrels were barrels that existed on paper. They now have what they call video barrels. Barrels of oil that don't exist, but are there only as speculative counters for you to buy and sell. So you've got to figure that every gallon that you've gotten out of your pump has been bought and sold 50, 100, 500, 1,000 times before it gets to you. And you've got to imagine this. Goldman Sachs reported a profit of $2 billion plus in the last quarter. Now you've got to figure, the losses for Goldman Sachs in the area of subprime mortgages, other kinds of paper, must be in the range of, $10 billion a quarter? God knows what, $15 billion per quarter? So what you see at the end, in other words, you can't get into the internal accounting practices of Goldman Sachs. They say our net profit is $2 billion. But that means that they must have had, let's just take a, I'll take a hypothetical case because I can't know these things. They must have gotten 20 or 30 billion out of oil speculation to offset losses of 15 to 20 billion or 25 billion in their other operations. In other words, it is essentially the speculation in oil that's keeping Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley similarly afloat. You get the idea?
Yes, and these people that run these companies are the same people that are running the government, right?
Yeah, Henry Paulson, the Secretary of the Treasury, is from Goldman Sachs. Robert Rubin, who seems to be the leading economic light for Obama, of course, is from Citibank.
Could you talk a little bit about how we got here? I mean, a whole series of safeguards that had been established to prevent a repeat of the financial and economic disasters of the 1930s were dismantled, right?
Yes, of course. That's what, when Newt Gingrich came into power in 1994-95, he's basically said, there's a quote from him, he says, "The purpose of my life has been to roll back the New Deal and to undo the work of Franklin D. Roosevelt." Now, let's also remember, you can say New Deal and Franklin D. Roosevelt, but that's also the sit-down strikes in Detroit. That's the Toledo Auto Light strike. That's the San Francisco General Strike. That's the Minneapolis General Strike. In other words, that is a series of labor struggles that allowed this to happen. In other words, Roosevelt was able to do these things because, in effect, he had a mass movement to lean on. In other words, he had labor pushing him, demanding that he do it, and he could, go to his political opponents and the Wall Street group, the Morgan group that hated him, and say, "Look, I have to do this because this is what the people are demanding, and they're organized and they're militant. And if you don't do this now, it's going to be worse for you later on because they'll come after you." That, by the way, just so people remember that the Morgan group essentially is the prime suspect in the attempted assassination of Franklin D. Roosevelt in Miami between the 1932 landslide victory and the March 1933 inaugural address. And then right after that, on the same day, right, the bank holiday, the fireside chats, and getting the U.S. out of the depths of the Depression where it had gone under Herbert Hoover. And then later on, the Morgan group attempted to organize a march on Washington in imitation of Mussolini's March on Rome. And they were going around looking for suitable demagogues, and they thought of MacArthur, and then they tried Smedley Butler. And Smedley Butler then told the public what they'd done. So Wall Street and the Morgan Group hated Roosevelt. And that hatred is what you see in Bush today, because Bush is the grandson, after all, of Prescott Bush, who with Harriman and Brown Brothers Harriman go right back to that Morgan Group in Wall Street in the 1930s. In other words, a pro-fascist, Roosevelt-hating group. So for many reasons, but above all for these economic structural reasons that you've just said, the reactionary Republican clique has attempted to dismantle this stuff. And, Clinton, unfortunately, during his presidency, what's the idea of abolishing welfare, in other words, aid to families with dependent children, which is a feature of the Social Security Act of 1935. How come we could pay for this in 1935 in a world economic depression, and we couldn't afford it in the mid-90s?
Now, you've talked at a length about some of the Depression-era New Deal legislation that Social Security, obviously, and re-regulation of a lot of the financial markets. But what about World War II? I mean, wasn't it World War II that really brought the country out of the Depression? I mean, that's a scary thought.
I wouldn't put it that way, because war does not lead automatically to economic recovery. If that were true, Bush the Younger would have caused an economic recovery. Instead, he caused an economic depression. In other words, you start the Afghan War and the Iraq War, that would normally, if war were the thing, then you should have prosperity as a result of that. And, of course, you don't. So you've got to go back and look at it. Unemployment in the United States, in spite of everything Roosevelt was able to do, he kept people in their homes, he kept food production up, and he created the beginnings of a recovery, which was then sabotaged by the Morgan Group itself. In other words, they went short in 1936-37 and created another downtick in the financial markets. They were trying to get Roosevelt's they were trying to get him politically. In the 36 election, he had scared the hell out of them. But generally speaking, unemployment remained high until Lend-Lease. Now, Lend-Lease is the U.S. is not at war. Lend-Lease is the moment where the credit system is essentially nationalized in the way that I would recommend today. In other words, what you want to go back to is, in effect, the same credit mechanisms you had under Lend-Lease. In late 1940, Roosevelt made this famous garden hose speech saying, "Look, we got to send stuff to the British here. We don't care about getting paid, right? If my neighbor's home is on fire, I'll lend him my garden hose so we can fight the fire. Otherwise, the fire may spread to me. And when it's all over, I don't care about getting paid. I just, you know, maybe you can give me the garden hose back. So this was a masterful piece of explanation. This led to Lend-Lease. Now, what it meant was that if you had a defense contract, you got a vendor number on there. You could take it to the local Federal Reserve or bank. You could take it to your local bank, and they had to give you credit on that. And then you took that to the bank, could take it to the Federal Reserve, which was legally compelled or politically compelled to discount it. Just remember, Roosevelt is the only president who de facto nationalized the Federal Reserve. And he did this, frankly, through blackmail. He said to Mariner Eccles and these other people, you know, you're so hated, I could nationalize you legally, formally. I could seize you, but I won't do it. This was a mistake. He should have done it. This is actually one of the biggest mistakes Roosevelt made in terms of his legacy, so to speak. I could seize you, but I won't. But here's what I'll do. I'm going to call you when the Treasury brings a note to market. I'm going to tell you the interest rate that you're going to buy it at. In other words, I'm going to nationalize you in this informal way. So during the war, the money supply and the interest rates were essentially dictated by Roosevelt through his various aides and experts, and the Federal Reserve operated as a bureau of the Treasury. Today, it's the opposite. As I said, today we have preferential credit rates for bankrupt banks and bankrupt investment houses. So they get low-cost credit, or at least lower-cost credit, in this set of things that Bernanke has set up. If you want to do speculation, you get low-cost credit. But if you wanted to create plant and equipment and hire some people and produce useful goods that people have got to have to live, then you take your chances in the market. It should be the other way around. The only answer is to nationalize the Federal Reserve. And again, if you want to criticize Roosevelt, criticize him for this. This is what he deserves. He should be criticized for not nationalizing the Federal Reserve when he could have at several points in his presidency. I mean, obviously in 1933, he could have done it, and he should have done it. But he decided not to because he was afraid of the blowback from the Morgan Group, who, after all, were apparently trying to bump him off and to hit him with a coup d'etat, right? So he had reason to fear that, and if they'd been stronger, they might have succeeded. So he shied away from that, and that is why we are now in this situation.
Economic historian Webster Tarpley, interviewed by Bonnie Faulkner of Guns and Butter. More on Webster Tarpley's writings and books can be found at tarpley.net, T-A-R-P-L-E-Y. And the Guns and Butter program can be found at their website, gunsandbutter.net. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. Last week, we began Chapter 5 of our serial reading of the book Power and Powerlessness by Dr. Susan Rosenthal, published in 2006. When we conclude our reading, I'm going to interview Susan, and the interview will include questions from you if you email them to me through the link at unwelcomeguests.org. Last week's chapter explained how, for most of human history, we lived in societies based on cooperation without bosses or rulers. Class society developed out of the surplus created by the invention of agriculture 10,000 years ago, as those who started as protectors of the community became masters of it. Ancient societies and present indigenous societies who follow ancient ways are based on a reciprocal relationship with other human beings and with nature. Last week, Rosenthal covered the idea of alienation, when we no longer own our own work or its fruits, and are severed from its creative aspects through its seizure by a ruling class. In previous chapters, we covered dissociation, The psychological defense of numbness and passivity that results when the actions of fleeing or fighting are unavailable. The danger our present society poses to individuals overwhelms our instinctual defenses with its complexity. Now we continue with the conclusion of Chapter 5 of Power and Powerlessness, as she puts those ideas together. Alienation and dissociation. Richard Sennett and Jonathan Cobb discovered that most of the people they interviewed for their book, The Hidden Injuries of Class, felt inadequate and powerless. One worker told them, "The more a person is on the receiving end of orders, the more the person's got to think he or she is really somewhere else in order to keep up self-respect. Yet it's at work that you're supposed to make something of yourself. So if you're not really there, how are you going to make something of yourself?" Close quote. This statement reveals the link between alienation and dissociation. Alienation is a condition of being cut off from control over the work process, being on the receiving end of orders. Dissociation is a psychological defense against powerlessness, having to go somewhere else. Dissociation preserves, quote, self-respect. However, dissociation keeps the worker trapped in his alienated condition. If you're not really there, how are you going to make something of yourself? In short, alienation makes dissociation necessary, and dissociation allows alienation to continue. Alienation and dissociation reinforce each other in innumerable ways. People who are forced to function like cogs in a machine have dissociated relationships with the other cogs. Instead of relating to each other as fellow producers, directly exchanging what they want and need, workers use their wages to purchase goods and services that are created by other workers. These workers relate to each other as dissociated consumers. You pay my boss for what I made, and I pay your boss for what you made. In effect, capitalism transforms human relationships into commodity transactions. There is no direct and conscious sharing of the creative, productive process. As a result, despite living, working, commuting, and shopping together, most people feel estranged from one another. We exchange superficial pleasantries, not knowing what else to say. Lack of control over the work process disrupts the bonds of mutual care that protected our ancestors. Pre-class societies did their best to provide for the elderly, sick, and disabled. Today, workers who become ill or injured discover that employers feel no loyalty to them. People who produce their entire lives are discarded like worn-out machinery, as employers gut pensions and politicians attack Social Security. According to the U.S. National Center on Health Statistics, starvation, dehydration, and bed sores are commonly listed as the cause of death on nursing home death certificates. Working people are not provided with paid leave to care for elderly relatives at home, nor do they earn enough to pay for private care. The result is helpless anguish as families watch loved ones die of neglect. How human beings relate to each other is inextricably linked with how they relate to the environment. Before class society, life was governed by the rule of reciprocity. Communal societies viewed the environment as an extension of themselves and treated it the same way as they treated each other, with respect and gratitude. They took only what they needed and gave back what they could. Class society severed the link between humanity and the environment in order to exploit both. Workers are used up and thrown away. Nature has become a source of raw materials to pillage on the one end and a massive toilet in which to dump garbage on the other. Natural resources are designated private property to be exploited for profit, regardless of the impact on people or the environment. We have all seen the result. Excess logging causes lethal mudslides. Shoreline development removes natural barriers to storms and tsunamis. The overuse of fossil fuels heats the atmosphere, melts the ice fields, causes sea levels to rise, and creates more turbulent weather. At the same time, there is no profit in reforestation, evacuating people in advance of storms, and relocating residents of flooded coastal areas. Hurricane Katrina demonstrated how disregard for human beings and disregard for the environment go hand in hand.